Hello and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, we often talk about on Brokenomics what it's going to be like what might cause the dollar to collapse. Themes like that, how things are going wrong in politics, how systems are becoming ever more complicated, more brittle. There's competency crisis. All of these things are pushing down to make these systems not really work. But it's all very well talking about when the dollar will collapse as some hypothetical future event. What's it like if you actually live through it? And of course, we don't know that yet, but Lionel Shriver has helped us out by writing this book, which is The Mandibles. It's all about a family who are expecting to come into some considerable fortune, who then actually end up, living through a dollar collapse and everything that comes with it and the evisceration of their wealth and all that. And in order to do that, we've got Chloe from The Proper Horror Show. So thank you very much for coming on. Chloe, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, Dan. It's an absolute pleasure. I just sort of sprung this on you when we met briefly, and I thought, this is my chance. I've got a pitch, Dan. Lionel Shriver's The Mandibles. I want to get your take on it.
Yes, well, I'm glad you did, actually, because you'd been doing various. I mean, your thing is presumably horror.
It's all horror movies. It's a massive focus on that and overanalyzing them.
Which is the best one? The best horror movie?
It would be Candyman from 1992.
Right, I haven't seen that one yet, so. I loved it.
Certain themes of like social decay and
right. We got a bit of that in this. While you were on a previous occasion talking horror with Harry, you mentioned this, like you said, and I thought, oh well, fair enough. I'll check it out, see what's there. It's a nice easy read. I mean, I read it on Saturday, so you can get through it quite quickly. But it's a fantastic book. Tell us about the premise of this. What's the setup?
Sure. I would say it's an absolutely biting satire, extremely dark, from an author who does like to do things centered around a topic. So she's done the obesity rates in a book called Big Brother. She's done various health services and tried to see how build a story around those. And I was she did We Need to Talk About Kevin, based on school shootings, which was the one that made her famous. And I'd appreciated those. I thought they're pretty interesting. And then someone who's a total normie passed me The Mandibles. And I couldn't believe it. It was like after a few years of watching, say, streams from certain butter retailers, I saw that and I couldn't believe it. It felt incredibly true to the sort of streams I've been hearing about Austrian economics and some of the harsher realities of current economic policies and social policies. And I was sort of seeing that stuff expressed in a novel, and I thought that was so interesting. It's amazing.
So, I mean, the setting in this is 2029. Mm. And there has been a catastrophic collapse. Now, I will say that what this book describes, this catastrophic collapse of the dollar, is not necessarily my base case of what I think is going to happen. Mm. Nevertheless, it is very much a possible future. And even if I put things turning out like they do in this book at, say, only 5%, well, that still means one in 20 possible futures is going to be what this book describes. Mm. So actually, I think it's everything that's described in this book, if certain things play out in the way that's described in this book, which is mainly down to the government response, because we all know that deficits are incredibly high. Deficits in the US are running about $1 trillion at the moment. Mm. We know that debt is skyrocketing. We know that people are increasingly losing faith in the dollar. You can see it now with European central banks. They're buying gold. Mm. They're getting out of dollar-denominated assets. So all it really requires is for the trends that are in place to continue and for the government not to change course at any point. Mm. And then you've got this, which is a catastrophic collapse. So, I mean, I say it's not my base case, but actually, if everything remains on its current track, this will happen.
Yeah, I mean, we'll keep relatively spoiler-free for the first part of this that's going to go
probably
out on YouTube.
Best, yeah.
But a lot of it is stuff that I've heard you say, and that's why I really wanted to bring it to you, the thing of the problem of the debts mounting and what you do in response to that. And typically, I think you've tended to say, the incentive for a politician who's in place for 4 years and then needs to get re-elected is kick can down the road.
Yeah. I mean, you like to think that when problems are very visible, when they're coming down the track and they're very visible, and because everybody in finance talks about the debt and the deficits and all those sort of things, you like to think that when a problem is very visible, that we are, as a species, fairly good at avoiding them.
Yeah.
But like you say, there's actually no incentive on a four-year election cycle for anyone to actually do that at any given point. So there needs to be some sort of impetus that goes into this. And the setup for this book is 2029. The US has been losing status for quite a while, as it is at the moment. So, we're having a discussion in the office just beforehand about, Rory was looking at shipping going under Africa. And I said, yeah, and it's interesting to note that the ships that are actually going through the Red Sea are all the China flagships because they offer superior protection. And the superior protection is not a massive military, not a massive navy. It's simply that they don't intervene around the world and upset people. So Chinese ships can travel through the short way and everyone else has to go the long way. So again, it ties so closely to what we're experiencing today. And a couple of things in the book. So, yeah, like you say, let's keep it fairly spoiler-like for the first half hour or so, and then we get super spoilery. But the first half hour, we just talk about the setup and the premise of maybe the first, 20% of the book or something, which we can largely go to.
Sure.
But in that world, things like the US has already lost the dial code 01.
Yeah, there are so many lovely little bits.
Little bits of flavour, yeah.
Yeah, flavour is a great description, where it just gets the impression across that the US has lost prestige in a major way. So losing the dial code, or in 2024, so the year we're filming this, there's an event that's an attack, a quite brazen attack on the internet supply in the US that knocks it out for a few weeks. Major cyber attack.
Which, interestingly, the WEF have been talking about quite a lot.
Yes, it reduces a country down to what they call the Stone Age, or the Stonage, as they use a neologism for, which I thought was quite nice. The use of neologisms in this book is fantastic.
Yes, it is.
There are so many signs, and also the demographic trends have meant that now when you dial up an official source in the US, it's one for Spanish, two for English.
Yes.
And you see how different people respond to this.
Well, this book assumes that mass immigration just continues for another 5 years after the point we're at now. And they have a Latino president, and he gave his inaugural address in Spanish.
Mm.
For example,
yes.
it's all things like that. So yeah, there's this major cyber attack, because there are several things that need to go wrong in order for this book to become plausible.
Mm.
And the first is a major event which basically knocks debt and deficits out of its already bad track into a disastrous track. Mm. Now, in this book, like you say, it's the Stone Age. It's when there's a cyber attack and they literally lose power. So that's why they call it the Stone Age, because they lose power and they lose internet and they lose devices and all that kind of stuff. And they have to sort of live in this Stone Age for, 6 months or I wasn't quite sure how long it was.
It's pretty vague, if I recall.
Yeah, it was quite vague. But it was a period of months that they're living without electricity before they sort of get it back up and running again. But you could substitute the Stone Age in this book for COVID.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, it was written in 2019, just before that happened. You know, that was another event which was, again, knocking the debt and deficit wildly out of control.
Yeah.
So you could be that. So so a major event that disrupts an organised, complicated system. That's one.
Mm.
Second one, it is no change of course on the thinking about debt and deficit. So the incentive structure, which you mentioned earlier, that doesn't change. And then basically it just comes to what is happening at the moment, which is this trickling loss of faith in the dollar just becomes a flood at some point.
There, and I think that's exacerbated by the arrival of an alternative, which is a collaboration between Russia and several other countries. I forget which specific ones to create.
China was the main one they mentioned.
China,
yeah.
Thank you. To create the bankor as a alternative reserve currency. Mm. And I just immediately started thinking, hang on, BRICS?
Yes.
Spark?
Exactly. Mm. So, I mean, the bankor is actually an old idea of John Maynard Keynes. So after the Second World War, there was much debate about, how international trade would be done. And that's really, really this whole thing got started, because the US had ended up with all the gold. They didn't want to give it back. And they said, look, it's OK. Mm. We'll just make the dollar as good as gold, and then everybody can trade in that, and that will be the international reserve currency. Mm. Which, as we talked about in the episode of Brokenomics a few ago, the Empire of Dollars with Justin, we described what that does to America, because it essentially hollows it out, because it requires the US to send debt abroad pretty much permanently in exchange for stuff coming in. Mm. And therefore the capacity to make stuff also goes abroad. So they hollow themselves out, manufacturing jobs leave, debt goes out, and actual stuff comes back in. Well, you run that forward, you know, many decades, and what you're left with is a country that can't actually do much for itself.
Yeah, you really get the sense in that book that the only things going on are service industry jobs and later looking after boomers. Looking after the old people is about
healthcare, and services.
Your stream with Justin, I thought, was incredibly timely, because you went into the reserve currency a lot there, and the book takes quite a while to explain reserve currencies to you, just so you get that.
Yes.
That's quite an achievement, making reserve currencies interesting to the average audience.
Oh, yeah, it was very, very easy to read, very straightforward. And it's all done in conversations between family members as well. You know, family members who get it more than others. And so the stupid question can be asked and a response can be given in a sort of, you know, fairly simplified way. So that's brilliant. So that's happened. There's been an event, COVID or the Stone Age, whatever to call it is. Mm. The mass immigration has continued. The high debt and deficits have continued. And then when that alternative just becomes viable to the point where more and more countries around the world have just said, yeah, we're going to go off it. And actually, I saw over the weekend, Egypt have just, and this is in the real world, this is our world, Egypt have just said, yeah, they're going to be doing all their foreign purchases in yuan now.
Really? That's gone amazing. Yeah. I'd heard talk of an agreement to buy oil in yuan.
Oh, yes, yeah.
As well.
Yeah,
that's... So it's
oil first, but then increasingly it will be everything else.
Amazing.
As well. So, I mean, this is starting to happen. So all that happens in this book that's different from what we are currently experiencing is, instead of it just being one country, it then becomes several more, and then several more, and then just the bulk of them go. Mm. And I think the way this book describes it is Europe, which is very much a vassal of the US, they're still on board with dollars, but everyone else has basically gone over to...
they've switched to the bancor, which is just secured against actual commodities.
So the idea of Keynes is it's just a basket of foreign currencies at a fixed rate, and then you periodically revalue them at different levels. But it's basically a basket of what we still call emerging economies. Mm. So the version that John Maynard Keynes talked about would have been the dollar and the yen and the pound and so on, but in this world it is sort of a section of emerging currencies.
So that's quite substantially different from the Keynes one, where
I think the model is the same, it's just the countries that make it up are different.
Oh, okay. I do correct me if I'm wrong. Yeah. I thought from reading that they'd try to move off a fiat currency for their bancor, and they're explicit about it had to be traded against a certain number of set commodities, not currency. So like hard.
Yes. So that, and in turn, their commodities are more. No, so their currencies are more commodity linked. So you get that through connection all the way through of the individual countries, their commodities, and then this bancor, which is basically just a collection of EMs and the commodities that they put into it. They do. I think she does mention BRICS very briefly and says that didn't work. But she essentially recreates the idea with this bancor.
She does. She mocks a euro as well. She basically assumes a euro has failed.
Yes.
She also assumed Barclays has failed, which is quite interesting. And there's a sort of, there are all these tiny little details that she doesn't elaborate on. Like we have in Britain, in that novel, we'd be under the Ed Balls regime.
Yes.
She's having a bit of fun with that.
Yes, quite. So these countries, they start to drop off. And so you've then, as we described in the Empire of Dollars Brokenomics, you've got all of these dollars, because there are far more dollars circulating throughout the world than the US actually needs. And if everybody is now exchanging all of their commodities and exports and all the rest of it in the bancor, well, they don't need dollars anymore. So these dollars start to flood back to the US, which causes sort of crippling inflation. And the sort of starting part of this book is a disastrous political reaction to all of that. Now, I say at the beginning, this isn't my base case, but again, that is simply the US doing what it's done before, because in 1971, when there was a sort of a prelude to this, and I mentioned that the US wanted to hang on to all of its gold, I think in 1971, it was the French who triggered that by saying, well, we think that you're printing more dollars than you've got gold to back it up. Mm-hmm. So we will have the gold. Thank you very much. So the political response to that say, okay, well, we're going to change it so the dollar cannot be converted into gold anymore. Mm-hmm. They break that connection. So it was not saying, okay, we're going to start spending less. The political response is, let's protect the government overspending and bring an incredibly harsh monetary and political response to this. And that's exactly what happens in this book.
Oh, yeah, exactly as you say. There's a sort of a setup, usually a social spending commitment as an incentive, and then the harsh reality when it results in things being more and more expensive is, do you cut it back? Do you sort of take down to sort of harsh reality of people can support what they can actually support? You're not going to do that, heck no. So you will create a bit of a fiction, you'll just print more money, but then that creates its own reaction to that, which you then have to deal with. Mm. But the last thing you can do is actually try and reset things to something real
or face harsh realities. Which they didn't do in 1971 in real life, and they don't do in this book. So again, the only thing necessary to bring about the preconditions for this are things that they've done in the past or are continuing to doing. And the only other factor is you know, they have this disasters policy response, and then they refuse to backpedal on it. So this is the political elite just simply not having a reverse gear.
Yeah.
And again, this is what they actually do in real life. So, I mean, you can talk about, you know, Ukraine or the weaponization of the US judicial system or any number of things. At no point do they say, OK, I think we've miscalculated. Mm-hmm. It is always doubling down and doubling down and doubling down. That's what really does the US in this book.
So do you think their reaction was believable, that was true to life, that they would, yeah, they wouldn't correct course?
Yeah, so me saying that I think, you know, this is not the most likely thing to happen is predicated on one of those conditions not coming to pass. However, I acknowledge that every one of those has a strong historical precedence, or is it what we're doing now? And also, so maybe I should revise it. Maybe it's not 5% that this is going to happen, but... the point is, I can well see us getting to the point of this starting to happen. So we said we wouldn't talk about the characters, but I have to talk about one character. And this is very early on in the book, so this is light spoilery at this point. The Mandibles refers to the Mandibles family, which is a very wealthy, historically wealthy family. I think the great-great-great-grandfather invented something in engineering, you know, some sort of steam and contraption or whatever it was. And so this has led to a large amount of wealth passing down through the family. So the beginning of the book, they're all talking about, well, they're not talking about, but they have these set of expectations that even though they live in modest means, at one point, great-grandfather is going to die and then all this wealth is going to come trickling down to the family and so on.
It feels incredibly well judged. The family is effectively just so you have a representative of each generation there, but yes.
And different scales of wealth and, yeah, political persuasions. It's got the whole American society in a microcosm.
Totally.
In this book.
And they're slightly thrown off by the fact that the eldest, the patriarch, the great-grandman, Douglas Mandible, just isn't dying. that lovely fortune of his is still tied up with him.
I think he's 97 when the book begins. But as this is starting to happen, and we can see that, you know, countries are peeling away from the dollar and they're going over to this bancor, Douglas Mandible, the patriarch of this family, I mean, he does kind of get what's happening. And he thinks he's protected himself. And this is a sort of great lesson number one that I sort of took from this, or I would like to impart from this via this book. Because... Douglas Boomer Mandible thinks that he has taken all the necessary steps to protect himself from a coming collapse of the dollar. And so I'll just read of a bit of a passage from this. So he's being pressed by his son on what he's going to do in response to this crisis. And he said, quite, I've steered clear of index funds, but only because I've got a piece of every company listed on the Dow. That aspect of the balance sheet could be grim, referring to a dollar collapse. But I hold gold ETFs and mining stocks. I even hold the title to bullion in a safety deposit box in downtown Manhattan. I always keep 10% in cash. So he thinks he's done the right thing. He's got gold stocks. He's got old gold ETFs. He's got even got gold in a bank vault somewhere. Mm. And he's got 10% kept in cash at the local bank. He doesn't actually have anything in his own hands.
No, exactly. It's ETFs. It's yep. nothing you can't put your hands on. And so if it goes down, what if you literally can't secure it? But still a faith in the system there, isn't there?
Yes, exactly. And this is the thing. So, I mean, even amongst people in our sphere who are very sceptical of the government and they kind of know how bad things can get and so on. I mean, I won't name names, but I've spoken to, you know, names you'd recognise, and they say, oh, well, I'm okay because I've got gold. And I say, oh, okay, excellent. How are you keeping it? And they say, well, I've got title to it somewhere. It's like, well, what you haven't got gold. What you've got is a promise to have gold, and somebody else has got the gold, and that can happen. So, I mean, I'll do a little bit of spoiling when I talk about the renunciation, which is the sort of the key thing that starts us off. Mm. So the Latino president, do you remember his name? Alvarez, is it?
I want to say Alvarez, yes.
Alvarez.
And so, also, he's not American. They remove the requirement, and then it's instantly they get their first...
Yes, the background to that is that Arnold Schwarzenegger took a run at the presidency, so they changed the constitution that you just need to be naturalized. And, so the president is actually a Mexican-born immigrant. I don't know if he's illegal or not, but however he came in. So anyway, so he gives this speech, and he sits down with the whole, you know, fellow Americans. I'm addressing you as the president, and then he's got a couple of pages of that thing, and it's interesting to read this speech and then go back and watch the 1971 Nixon when they moved off the gold standard, because they don't frame it as we've screwed up. They don't say we've been overspending. The whole framing is, you know, these are evil foreigners coming against us. He's talking about, what does he say? So during this past week, our nation has once again been under attack. No towering skyscrapers have been humbled. Both physical and digital systems on which we depend continue to function. But yet these attacks are currently sustaining as no less devastating than nuclear missiles hurled towards our city. Mm. So he's got the classic sort of American establishment mindset that the dollar is this immutable thing, this bedrock. And any attack on the dollar is illegitimate, fundamental, and it's like an act of war. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of extraordinary part there. And he goes on and on about how they've come into attack. But let's talk about his response to this. He says, and this is further into the speech, right before addressing you, the American people, this evening, I convened an emergency session of Congress. Almost unanimously, your representatives passed a bill deeming that until further notice, for American citizens to hold bankers, either onshore or offshore, will be considered an act of treason. So he makes it impossible for people to hold the alternative to the dollar. He just makes it illegal and treasonous. He goes on to say that he's going to limit withdrawals for a temporary period to $100. Mm. These temporary acts that happen, like Malta did this after the the 2008 crisis, and they limited in a similar way, and they said they were going to be doing it for a few weeks, and I think it's 4 years or something.
Yeah, the idea is he's doing that so you can't do a bank run.
Yes.
So he's getting in there early, and many a temporary policy hung around a little bit longer, was that income tax originally to fight the war against Napoleon?
Yes, exactly right. Yes, that was a temporary measure as well.
Yes.
Yeah, and the not converting dollars into gold in 1971, that was supposed to be a temporary measure as well. Mm. And here we are, whatever it is, 53 years later, still going. He then goes on later to say, using the powers vested in your president by the International Emergency Economic Powers Act of 1977, I am calling in all gold reserves held in private hands. Gold mining operations within our borders will be required to sell ore exclusively to the United States Treasury. Gold stocks, exchange-traded funds and bullion will likewise be transferred to the Treasury. In contrast to FDR's gold nationalisation of 1933, because of course the US has actually done this before, we will not be making any exception for jewellers or jewellery. So you need to hand over your wedding ring as well. So
That really stood out to me, that she so often goes out of her way to reference things that have already happened.
Yes.
Just to make it more, so you can't sort of shrug it off as, oh, this is fantastical. She's like, no, we have precedence for this.
Yeah, and, you know, what the US has come to realise that it's been printing dollars for so long that those dollars don't have any value. So it immediately turns, well, the US does actually need some foreign trade, not least to pay for the pharmaceuticals to keep the boomers alive, which is the voting bloc that operates the political system in the US. So in order to get those pharmaceuticals and a few other bits that it needs from abroad, because of course the US has no manufacturing capability, well, it still has some, but it's been greatly denuded at this point, they need gold. So they're going to have to call in every scrap of gold that they possibly can from bank vaults, ETFs, but they go further in the people themselves as well. And what I found interesting was they actually sort of describe sending troops out to people to try and get the gold off them. I mean, that was a striking bit in the book, wasn't it?
Very early on. And yeah, I thought the clever bit about that was a dual purpose of it, which was just boots on the ground, showing them they're willing to use hard power.
Yes.
Because they ultimately, they don't do a great big search, but through the house, they aren't super thorough, don't check everywhere, but they are there to show that they are a physical presence, that there will be no exceptions.
Yeah,
and that really stood out to me.
She describes it very well in the book. I mean, they bang on the door demanding gold. They put up their protest and say, oh, you know, you can't come in here, we're free citizens, we can sue you. And the soldier just says, I've heard that 80 times today. And then they go in and they make a great show of pretending to find something in the sofa cover. So they start cutting up the sofa with box cutters to go through it. And they sort of stomp noisily through the house, tearing cupboard doors off and pulling paintings off the wall and going around with their metal detector. And they describe it very well in the book. The purpose is not that they expect to find anything, because in a big house you could easily hide something if you gave it some thought. The point is to put so much psychological pressure on you that when they then say halfway through, if you just tell us where there is anything, we make sure you get off lightly.
Yeah, they know people will comply or give in under pressure.
And which is exactly what the main character in this book does. I think she has some goblets or something that got a bit of gold trimming on them.
That's it, yeah.
And she's on the verge of handing it over before a sort of sensible son, you know, stops that from happening. So, you know, that's a setup. Gold has been called back in before. That happened in 1933 under FDR. They did have an exemption for jewellery, which is knocked out on this. But basically, any bullion that you hold, you had to turn over to the US government. You had to do it about $20 per ounce.
Am I right in that you were offered some kind of certificate or bond in exchange for them at a certain price?
Yeah.
Price was not exactly going rate.
I think it was $20.67, if I remember correctly, was the amount that you got paid for your gold. That then stayed effectively illegal for sort of best part of 30, 40 years. When gold became tradable again, when the US relaxed its restriction on people owning gold, you know, it started trading at something like $183, so a considerable markup from the 20 that they had bought it from. And within a year or so, no, by the end of the decade, it was trading at $800.
Gosh, that's reminded me a bit before that was when Britain sort of considered going back on the gold standard, and then realised that the markup for that would diminish the pound so much that it was politically unfeasible.
It's very easy to go off gold, but it's very, very, very difficult to go back on gold.
It's a real recurring theme in the book that, how can I say, that the things that you may have faith in, you may believe on faith, don't need to actually be backed up, whether it's sort of, you can tell the soldiers rifling through your house, my rights, my constitution.
Yes.
but you, that's not keeping them out, and your dollars, if they're not backed by anything, are not going to be worth anything if people don't also believe in it. It's this, you know, it's a theme they return to over and over again.
Oh, the book is very good at saying, giving you example after example of how just because you think the world operates this way, it only operates that way because you think it operates that way.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.